From Chicago, on the north side, doing work, getting ready to go back home. It's done. Listening to the Gangland Wire podcast on my iPod. Talk to you later. Bye.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old ice house in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we're going to talk, this is for you, Red Womette and Mike Byrne, and I think it's Ross Stranger, Chicago guys, Ben Ellickson, our favorite Chicago guy. I'm sitting here looking at our City of Chicago flag that you were so kind as to send us. We are honorary Chicagoans down here in the Big Dumb Fun Show studio. Aaron, did you know that?
We did that a couple weeks ago.
We did. We had a live Facebook event, the hanging of the Chicago City flag. Well, tonight we're going to talk about the outfit and Chicago cops. Now, you guys from Chicago, you know that there have been a few corrupt policemen up in Chicago. In the 1950s, out of the Prohibition era and into the World War II time, when really there was hardly anybody on police departments, and on up into the 50s, most large police departments had at least a few, maybe some more or some less than others, corrupt policemen. And they were connected to the outfit or to the mafia, the local La Cosa Nostra, because those guys know that they need political connections and they need police connections into law enforcement in order to keep operating. Kansas City Police Department, we had our share. We had a big change in 1960. We got a new chief of police, a man named Clarence Kelly, who was actually grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, so he knew a lot of people here, and he'd gone away and become an FBI agent. And FBI agents, of course, were known to be incorruptible, especially back in those days. So Clarence Kelly left the FBI and was hired as chief of police in Kansas City, and he kind of did a little bit of cleaning. He didn't run around and have investigations, but he selectively transferred certain people into positions where they couldn't get information or where they couldn't exert too much authority, and encouraged some of the older people to retire who he got word that they were corrupt. He started the Top Hoodlum Squad, or the Intelligence Unit, which was a squad of detectives that worked just for him. And that's why, and I worked in the Intelligence Unit later on, as a lot of you guys know. And that's one thing that we were tasked with, was if there was a criminal operation going involving policemen, they didn't give it to the Crimes Against Persons Unit. They didn't give it to Internal Affairs. They gave it to us. And, for example, in the 1970s, just before I came to the Intelligence Unit, when my good friend Bobby Arnold was already there, law enforcement, the FBI, and other Kansas City police officers discovered there was a kind of a multi-officer, a little group of officers that had a theft operation going. One of them was worked off duty for Sears and a Sears warehouse. One of the officers worked off duty there. He was closely connected to the private security or Sears employee who hired the off-duty officers to work there. And they started stealing things like televisions and water heaters and hot water heaters and furniture and tools and everything off the docks at Sears, and then selling it out through stores and other friends. There was policemen buying this stuff. They swore that they didn't know it was stolen. They thought they were just getting a big discount because these guys worked for Sears. But
They did get a big discount.
They got a huge discount, yes. I talked to one of them. He was kind of nervous. He said, I thought it was kind of funny when he said, meet me down by the docks and bring a pickup. And then they just took a hot water heater right out of a rail car, and we loaded it up in the back of my truck, and it was pretty cheap. But he said, I didn't know. And, when they started running a surveillance on these guys, they needed to catch them in the act, and they need to find out what they were doing with the stuff. And this good friend of mine, Bobby Arnold, was in the intelligence unit at the time, and he tells a story. His wife still will not let him forget this. One of these detectives, corrupt detectives, has a cabinet shop. He's a part-time cabinet maker, and he has a cabinet shop over in Northeast, what we call the Northeast area, over off of St. John and Belmont, and kind of a storefront operations. And Bobby's job was to go into an apartment on the second floor across the street from this cabinet shop, because they figured out that some of the property was maybe going in and out through the cabinet shop. It was cold, and there was no, this was an unfurnished apartment, and there was no heat in it. He would, like, sneak in through the back and go up some back stairs and get up in the apartment and look out the window. It was really cold, and he'd have to spend, you know, 4 or 5 hours at a time there. So he brought a sleeping bag from home and got in the sleeping bag and would sit up by the window and watch out the window with his radio and let them know if anybody came or went and what they were doing. So he takes that sleeping bag home at the end of this. And about 3 or 4 days later, after this is over and he's brought the sleeping bag back home, they have a huge roach infestation. It seems that the sleeping bag roaches were in that apartment. The sleeping bag got infested with the roaches, and he took the roaches home. And God, his wife was mad at him. So, but we ended up busting all them. They all cop pleas except one, and retired immediately. If you get a charge and you like have a pension coming as a policeman, you get some kind of a charge. Doesn't matter what kind of charge it is, as long as you plead guilty, as long as you retire before you plead guilty, then you can save your pension. And all these guys were vested and they were able to save their pensions. They got probation. They all got five. I remember they all got 5 years probation, except one guy. God, I can't remember. Don Messinger or something like that. Don, he was a check fraud detective, and he pled not guilty, and he went to trial, and he got found not guilty. So he stayed on after this whole deal was over, and then he got caught in another deal, which they had him even better on some other thing. I don't even remember what it was, and he went ahead and took his retirement and caught some kind of an actual conviction out of the next thing he got involved in. But those were kind of the last of the organized old-time ring.
Corrupt cops.
Corrupt cops, yeah.
Back in the day when it was kind of normal to...
Yeah, like, you know, it was when I came on, it was nothing. There were several restaurants, and you just go in and you just expected to eat for free. It was just, I don't know, just that's the way it was. And that slowly but surely started going away. I kind of hated to have to start paying for all my food. but you know, that wasn't right that we would eat for free either, because they expected something out of us.
Yeah. Well, it'd be hilarious if that guy that didn't catch that case wrote him a check for one of those washers or dryers.
Yeah, bad check. I'm like, well, since he was a bad check detective,
right? I'll look right into that for you. Yeah, but well, so this, I mean, now we kind of you get a little summary of Kansas City, but what we're really interested in is Chicago,
right? Yeah, we're talking about Chicago. Now, it was on the Chicago Outfit Old and Current News and Articles, Mike Burns' page, and Red Mamet does a lot of posting on that, that a particular posting of a newspaper article, and that's what he does. He finds great articles out of mainly the Chicago Tribune. This really caught my ex-Chicago top cop who ran mobbed-up jewelry ring dies. Now, I'll kind of tell you the end of the story as far as he goes. He dies, but he dies of old age. There's a lot more. I started researching into this guy. His name was William Hanhart. He was in his 80s when he died. It came out later on in the family secrets testimony that when he first got started, Hanhart was getting $1,000 a month and a new car every 2 years from the Chicago Outfit. As with most people, he was a multidimensional fellow. His family said that he was a wonderful man. He lived his whole life just helping other people. His daughter said, "Heaven gained an angel this morning when he died." He had a birthday party just before he died, and she said everybody got to spend time with him. It was a beautiful party. He said Christmas was his favorite holiday. He always vacationed in Minnesota for the last 60 years.
I bet it was. He probably given everybody jewelry.
Yeah, really. His son-in-law described him as the greatest detective ever.
Well, here we're going to hear what says Hanhart, former deputy police superintendent and chief of detectives had died on that Friday in Highland Park Hospital from complications from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, according to his family.
Yeah, COPD, I see that get a lot of people.
Maybe he was a smoker.
Yeah, more than likely.
Here it says he had lived in Deerfield and previously lived in the far northwest side's Edison Park neighborhood, where the funeral is scheduled for the Tuesday. This article coming out December 30th, 2016.
Here's one of his friends, a guy named Thomas Sullivan, who at one time had been a U.S. attorney in Chicago in the late 70s. And he was, you know, being interviewed by the, in the article, said that when he was a young defense attorney, he had first met Hanhart. And at that point, it was in the 1960s, and that's when he's already taking $1,000 a month and getting a new car every 2 years. Sullivan had represented several police officers who were charged with killing Black Panthers Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in 1969. And so Sullivan had, like, you know, this guy was probably their commander and probably involved in the whole operation. I don't know if anybody remembers that. But Chicago police did a raid on the Black Panthers headquarters, and seemed like they just started shooting right off the bat and killed a couple of them. Got charged with murder and then got found not guilty, and this guy was one of their lawyers. He describes Hanhart as having a very commanding presence, a big man. He was a fine police officer. That was my understanding and my belief. He ended up working as one of his lawyers later on when Hanhart was charged with a crime.
Yeah, because he was a officer and had retired before he ever got charged with the jewelry heist.
Yeah, he made it all the way through. Now, a little bit of his history, he became a police officer in 1953, and even early on, he started out making headlines. 1962, it was reported he encountered three robbers. One of them had a machine gun. He had a shootout with them, killing two. Now, how he probably, it was probably some outfit guys that told him about these three robbers and set him up, more than likely, because during that time he was helping the outfit out. So who better of a source to have than somebody in the outfit? The only thing you got to do is help them avoid detection from the FBI and other things like that, and the vice, and, you know, let them know if there's going to be a police raid on a gambling game that they got. Then they would turn around and give you somebody. I can see that happening. Later on in 1973, there was a horrendous crime. A Hillsdale, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago, police officer named Anthony Raymond, he had stopped three men, professional criminals, and he stopped them, right, and he didn't realize this, right after they'd robbed a restaurant of $5,000. They jumped out and they got the drop on him and killed him and then buried his body. Our friend William Hanhart had an informant that told him who the suspects were and where to find the body. Later on, 1976, he was personally was able to catch the killer of a Chicago cop named Thomas Loftus. The murderer in that one was a Hispanic gangbanger. He was kind of guy that he was probably like J. Edgar Hoover. When some of his guys did something came to his attention, he made sure that he got in there and was in on the bust, and then gave the statement to the newspaper so he would get the credit for anything. He was really well known by reporters and FBI agents. He was able to provide background information to the FBI and the reporters on Chicago crimes and the different political liaisons that go on in any big city. He was really connected well politically. He knew how to curry favor in every area of Chicago life, whether it be politicians or rich people or federal law enforcement.
Well, he probably had some good sources, you know.
Yeah, he had the best.
Because he was working with the outfit.
Yep, he had the best.
So all those other crimes that were occurring outside of the outfit were probably more stringently prosecuted.
Yes, much more stringently prosecuted. And they'd find out about it, but it was some non-outfit connected dot guy. Why, you know, they had people in every area of life. They could tell him so-and-so was responsible for, well, like these three guys that killed this officer. Probably they were professional. Well, no, they were professional criminals. They go back home and they start talking about this stuff, and other criminals find out about it. Well, they immediately, you know, get the word goes into the outfit, and then they know they need to make their man Hanhart look good, and this doesn't cost them anything. These guys were throwaways. They weren't doing anything for the outfit. They didn't owe them anything. That would be how it worked. 1979, there's a lot of heat on him. Word's kind of getting around. He's demoted to the traffic squad because he had been accused of playing footsie with the mobsters. Particularly the mobsters that the outfit crew that ran the downtown area. But, you know, just within a few months, he's promoted back to chief of detectives with a new superintendent who was appointed by the mayor, Jane Byrne. The superintendent who was kind of his champion from then on was a guy named Richard Brzezczak. By 1993, this is what, 1980, by 1993, after he's got another 10 years or so as chief of detectives and involved in every major investigation and knows every major investigation that goes on in Chicago, probably our friend Jim Paydar would have worked under him when they did the, remember that one?
The
janitor and drum.
Janitor and the drum.
Murders, yeah, this guy would have known all about that and probably fed all the details, the investigation to the mob. To the outfit. 1993, Teamsters official Alan Dorfman was killed by a couple of outfit hitmen. I believe Frank the German Swiss and I can't remember the other one were involved with the hit on Dorfman. When the investigative officers started going through Dorfman's personal effects, they found his telephone book, and in it were William Hanhart's contact information, both at work and at home. Kind of after that name turned up and everybody, you know, the FBI knew it and higher ranking people in the Chicago PD knew about it, he ended up being sidelined, but they let him go ahead and finish out his career as a district commander, which kept him out of the mix as far as investigations were concerned.
When it was more just a paperwork shuffler?
Well, district commander, he would have, like commander over Central Patrol. He would have all the uniformed people. Maybe some parking control, maybe a small anti-crime squad and community interaction officers and things like that. He wouldn't be involved in any investigations like the you know, murder investigations or like the intelligence unit, any organized crime investigations, any vice investigations. So you're not really in a position. He probably had plenty of friends in those positions. If he wanted to know something, he could probably find it out.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, before that, he was involved in the trials for Anthony Spilotro.
Yeah, really, just before he retired. That's a hell of a story. Anthony Spilotro, Tony Spilotro's on trial.
Our friend Frank Culotta might know.
If Culotta would know, we should get him on the phone on this dude. He would know about him. But one of his last official acts was to testify not for the government, but for the defense in the... Spilotro, see, he was charged in the conspiracy to skim money from the Las Vegas casinos, but he got his trial separated. And Hanhart, in the first trial, Hanhart testified in order to discredit one of Spilotro's key accusers. It was probably Frank Culotta. I didn't research into that long enough to see who it was. But Spilotro got a mistrial on that first casino skimming trial, and when he was waiting the second trial was when he was killed. But during all this time, until after he was retired, was he'd been leader of a band of jewelry thieves who stole, they totaled up as much as $5 million in jewelry over the last 12 years, starting in 1984 and ending in 2000 when he was indicted. He, of course, fenced the jewelry through connections that he had with the outfit. I said it seemed like he was he could think like a criminal. Well, he could think like a criminal because he was one. He used all kinds of techniques that he had learned working as a policeman on how to do some really diabolically clever jewelry thefts. He, of course, used a lot of, even after he retired in whatever that was, I think it was 86, he still had cop friends on the job and had other private detectives and trying to get leads on potential victims, targeting, he would target gym salesmen who were traveling around with valises of valuable samples. We had a crew here in Kansas City that did that. It's a constant gathering the intelligence on salesmen. They used to travel around with samples and hit different jewelry stores. They need to know what kind of cars they had. They'd follow them. In many cases, they just simply tail a salesman, and this happened in Kansas City too. They'd break into his vehicle, and they'd get as much as $300,000 just out of the guy's trunk. I can't believe that they'd drive around and leave that kind of money in his trunk. I remember one guy here in Kansas City, he was staying at a crapola little motel over in Independence, and he left it in his motel. Well, they'd been following him, a guy named Johnny Joe Kalia, and I think Frankie Angotta maybe, but anyhow, Johnny Joe Kalia was definitely one of them. Oh, maybe, I'm not going to say this one guy's name because he's still around. Could be litigious because he didn't catch a case for it. Johnny Joe's in the joint for similar kinds of things, so we won't worry about him.
Did you know he was involved in this one?
Best my memory, he was. But, you know, he's just had a little crapola motel, and he leaves, you know, $150,000 worth of jewelry samples inside this motel and goes out somewhere and goes out to eat or drinking or something. They just break in his hotel room and get it. They would. They used to, like, find your car, figure out how to make a key, a similar key you could get into the glove box. And many times cars, and back in those days in the 70s, cars would have a key code inside the, with the paperwork for the car, and then they'd go out and make a key, and then they'd have a key for your trunk, and then they'd follow you around and then just wait until you left the car alone with your samples in the trunk, and then just unlock the trunk and take them out. They got $500,000 worth of Rolex watches in California in 1986. There's another in 1989. There's $125,000 jewelry theft in Iowa. There's $1 million in Michigan, $240,000 in Minnesota in 1993.
But they'd only been doing it for 12 years.
Yeah,
they did. That's what they copped to.
That's what they copped to.
We only got $5 million. You add all this up here, you got $1 million, $1.5 million, $1.8 million, $2.4 million. You know, you're like, you're describing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 robberies, and there's like $2.5 million.
Right there.
But they only ever got $5 million.
They got more than five. Years. Of course, and then those valuations are one thing. That's like, who knows, when they say they stole $1 million worth of jewelry from me, who knows what they really stole from me. Maybe they really only stole $500,000 worth from me, and I'm going to make $1 million insurance claim.
Yeah, so I was going to say, cause some of this would be tracked because the guy that was the salesman that gets robbed, he's not going to turn around and reimburse the company.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works.
They have to file a police report, you know, get an insurance claim. And here's another story you've got where they get another $1 million in Dallas.
Yeah, that was the old, they got an identical salesman sample bag to the salesman and followed him around a little bit, and he set it down. He wasn't looking. They set down the identical bag and picked up his bag and walked off. Pretty slick, huh? I think one of the best ones, though, this was Hanhart. They said it was his biggest score in 1994. For 2 months before a gym wholesaler show in Columbus, Ohio, they had kind of like the show was at a convention room or a big room in a hotel, so all the salesmen would be staying there. So the salesmen, when they weren't down on the sales floor, they would check their lock boxes behind the counter in the hotel, and they would check in their jewels and leave them in those lock boxes. So a gang member, Hanhart, had one of their gang members check in the hotel like every other day. And how they figured this out, he used the same name. His name was Sol Gold, S-O-L-G-O-L-D. I think he has a sense of humor, huh? And he'd always ask to store valuables in the hotel safety deposit boxes. As he would do that, then he'd get his key. So he systematically copied each key. And when he got enough of those keys, Hanhart somehow was able to look at those and create a master passkey for all the boxes. And then when the jewelry show started, they got in behind they distracted the desk clerk, got back in there with the passkey, and took all the jewels out. Got $2 million, they say. Now, that's one that they got caught on. the woman, a woman who went with one of the guys involved in this scam or this jewelry thing, went to his wife, the guy's wife, and said, you know, I've been messing around with your husband. Ended up, the wife then ended up going to the FBI and ratting him out. I'm interesting from that chief of police or the police commissioner, Breshtek. I knew he had an illustrious career. A lot of people knew him. He knew a lot of people, but I don't have any evidence whatsoever of him being outfit connected. But the federal government had plenty of evidence. They had 1,307 incriminating phone calls. They wiretapped his home phone for a year. Can you imagine that? For a year.
1,300 wiretaps.
1,300 separate calls. They there's actually many more calls than that, but those are ones that they had to put in as evidence, I got a feeling.
I wonder if that was him talking about that Mr. Soul Gold.
Probably.
Or Mrs. Soul Gold.
He pled guilty in 2002. He was ordered to pay $5 million in restitution and was sent to, there's like a minimum security prison, federal prison up in Minnesota, and he got 12 years.
At a country club prison.
At a country club prison.
Doesn't that seem a little unfair because, you know, he's a cop. Shouldn't they hold him to a little higher standard?
Well, I don't know.
But everybody had good things to say about him after he passed away. They didn't want to focus in on the fact that he had committed these crimes, that he was ultimately convicted for them. And in fact, when he was convicted, he pled guilty, and then that kind of shut the whole case down. Like there wasn't more to get out of it because he just said, I'm guilty.
Yeah, they actually had enough on him and his whole crew to indict everybody that was involved. One of them was Sam DiStefano, who is
Mario DiStefano's son.
Paul Shiro, who had left Chicago, but he was still part of the outfit and moved to Scottsdale. William R. Cherry Nose Brown. James D'Antonio, who was at one time the driver and a top lieutenant for Joy the Clown, Joseph Lombardo. And he was the one that maintained a lot of the intelligence files on the traveling jewelry salesman. There's a Robert Paul, who was a private eye and helped him conduct surveillance of jewelry stores and salesmen down in Arizona. Guy Altobello of Elmhurst, who was a reported top associate of mob boss James Turk Torello, outfit mob boss. Altobello had a son who owned a jewelry store up in Chicago area, and they also supplied information, inside information about jewelry salesmen and, you know, what would be the best salesman to hit, and what would be the most opportune time. So it was a big, long intelligence gathering operation about jewelry salesmen. They kept files. It would be like any intelligence operation where they would follow these jewelry salesmen. They were getting information from other jewelry store owners who were probably helping them fence the stuff, keeping all that information and figuring out the best way to do it and then doing it.
Got to wonder if any of this jewelry ended up out in Las Vegas.
Well, it could have. You know, certainly Tony Splatro had the Gold Rush, a
jewelry store
that would have sold jewelry out there. Of course, he had a crew of his own out there doing jewelry store break-ins. Hanhart even personally participated in some of these thefts. He even personally helped follow certain jewelry salesmen, served as a lookout. As the U.S. attorney said, the hallmark of this jewelry theft ring was its extreme sophistication and planning. Well, that's because they had a top police commander in charge of this whole thing, which is kind of interesting. I mean, the mob guys, they were actually, the way this came out from the investigation, everything I've read, that Hanhart was actually in charge of all these guys.
Well, weren't some of these guys also the ones that were involved in the Marlboro Diamond heist?
No, that was Jerry Scalise and Art the Brain. God, all of a sudden I've lost his last name. But no, they were actually during this time they were in jail in England for that particular jewelry theft. Now, had they been in Chicago, they might have been involved with this jewelry salesman. If you're going to follow them around and find out, you get their license number, and then you got police contacts to check the license and find out where they live. If they've gotten, then you'll run it and see if they've got any traffic tickets and where they've got them. where they work. There's all kinds of information you can get out of law enforcement computers.
Wasn't it something that I think I had read where it said they got their credit scores? And
yeah, you get a PI who has access to credit reports, and he can go into the credit report and find out where you, what bank you use and where you borrowed money. And it's got a, I used to be able to get credit headers. When I first started practicing law, I did a subscribe to a service where I couldn't get your actual report, but I could get your header, and it'd have all your old addresses. It was like the best way to find somebody is to get the credit headers, because anybody that's got a credit card, they're going to keep their most recent address
on file
with the credit card company, who are going to, when you change addresses, they're going to report it to the credit reporting bureau. So it's really the best way to find somebody, of any way to find them.
The way that they went about the robberies were, I mean, it was really about as safe as, instead of going into a jewelry store, you know, and saying this is a robbery, you know, they would hit these salesmen who were pretty vulnerable, just being traveling around the country by themselves in a car. You know, once they figure out who they were and they could maybe tail them, everyone's got to sleep, right?
Yep, they got to sleep. They got to go in and eat.
Yeah, unless you're going to sit on that case 24 hours a day.
And they're human beings, so they may like
go to a strip club
or go into a bar. Did I ever tell you my story about the strip club? I'm sitting there with this informant, me and a couple other guys. We're sitting there with this informant in a strip club. And he said, he made some comment about a guy that was sitting there and he had a Snap-on tool uniform on. The guy worked for Snap-on Tools. And I had remembered there was a Snap-on tool truck out in the parking lot. Well, I didn't think anything about it, but this guy did. And
maybe he was making a delivery.
Well, he was he was wanting to get a lap dance, is what he was wanting to do. My informant, I don't really, you know, he scared the dog shit out of me on this one. He said something about that tool guy being in there and his truck out there, and I thought, well, you know, what's he talking about? Pretty soon he calls one of the gals over and he whispers to her and he hands her some money, and she goes over to the Snap-on tool guy. I can see her bending over, starting to talk to him, and then she starts giving him a lap dance. Well, my guy then gets up and leaves. About the time she gets done with the lap dance, he comes back in, and he just shook his head. He said, I didn't have anything in that truck. I thought, oh, shit. He just went... He got that dancer to distract that guy and make sure he didn't go out while he went out to steal tools out of that truck. Thank God he didn't have anything in there. I'd have been a party to a theft. Now, I didn't mind walking the edge, but I didn't want to be that close to the edge.
Well, that's what he told you. He might have known well enough to just say, oh, there wasn't really anything in there, and still cleaned it out.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true. I didn't ask no more questions.
But he wanted you to know that he had just did that.
Yes, he did. He did. See, that's what you got to watch with informants. You start working on informants, and hell, that may be how Hanhart got started working with informants, and pretty soon they do little things to try to suck you in. This same guy, he wants, I said somebody had a really nice leather coat. He said, oh, he said, I got people to get these. What he meant was shoplifters, of course. And he said, you want one? He said, I'll get you one. And I said, no, man. I don't need a leather coat. No, thank you.
Did he offer to buy you a lap dance?
No, he never did that either.
Go out and he's rifled through your car.
He was a piece of work. He was picking my brain while I was picking his. I don't know who came out ahead on that deal.
Well, these guys went on in Chicago for nearly two decades.
They did. You know, they used aliases. They used disguises. They got the key codes to the cars. They had key-making equipment. They were like a police unit. They used walkie-talkies to keep in contact with each other. They even had smoke bombs and bulletproof vests just in case they had some kind of something went wrong and there was some kind of a gunfire and they needed to throw a little smoke out there and distract somebody. They had that one deal. They switched the jeweler's cases with the exact same case, so the guy wouldn't even know that it happened until many, many hours later. That whole thing at the hotel with the keys for the safety deposit boxes in the hotel, that was ingenious. That was friggin' ingenious. I wonder if that guy thought of that on his own.
You had to think about that. You know, like he'd go in and go, I'm checking in. I want a lockbox. And you go and get, you know, they give you a lockbox. And then you're like, so you get a key for it.
And you just make a copy of it.
And then you go back and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to check out. And I check back in another day, get it, or misses. You know, I go in and I get another lockbox, another key. You're just, it's, I mean, maybe you get a master key. I can't imagine that they'd be like, well, here's the key to your lockbox, and it's a master key.
No.
I could see how you could make duplicates of a bunch of different lockbox keys.
That's what he did.
And then I don't know that you could figure out how to make a master, but you could certainly go back into the room and open up all the lockboxes that you had keys made to.
Right, but according to the information I got was that Hanhart was able, by looking at enough of those keys...
To figure out
what... There must be, you know, have a master key. You have to have some particular thing that each key doesn't have. And I would imagine, from what I read, if you get enough of them, and with a locksmith that knows what they're doing, they can then make a master key for something like that. So, I'm not familiar enough with keys.
And then, obviously enough, they must have something happened because the desk clerk, you would think, would go into the room and leave them alone.
You mean back where the safety deposit boxes are? No, they don't. As a matter of fact, like if you go to safety deposit box in your bank, they leave you alone. They do not stand there and watch what you're doing.
Where do you bank at?
Police credit union. And go rob
it. No. Just kind of check in and out.
But no, they...
a couple of lines.
They always give you privacy when you have a safety deposit box. Now, it's probably a little bit different in a hotel. You know, now they put, you know, little personal safes in each room for most hotels. But back in these days, they had safety deposit boxes. Women to put their jewelry in. If you were carrying something you thought was valuable, you'd want to leave in the room while you leave in the safety deposit box, which would be behind the desk, somewhere back behind the desk. You just go in there, and the clerk wouldn't get to walk back in there with you.
Well, and he certainly wouldn't think you'd have a master.
No, he wouldn't have any idea you had a master.
I mean, you'd have to go through, you know, a number of lock boxes just to try to guess, open, close, until you actually got one that had something in it.
Yeah, but
it's a wallet. Oh, okay, never mind.
Remember, there was a jewelry.
Yeah, convention.
Salesman's convention, and they were all putting their stuff in there. So there was probably a whole lot of them that had. They got $2 million worth of jewelry, so there's probably a whole lot of them that had. Plus, you get some good-looking woman to go up in front and distract the clerk, depending on the clerk.
Buy her a lap dance.
Yeah, well.
Or him. Well, and then the thing, of course, is that it takes a little bit of time, and you know, you're like, oh, hey, I'm walking in, getting something out of my lockbox, and you come back out with like $2 million. That's like, you would think I don't know, it's kind of weighted. Maybe they had like a hidden pair of pocket in their pants.
Well, sure, it'd be easy to have a coat with inside pockets on to stick a couple million dollars worth of jewelry, or maybe you had two or three different people.
Go in and had a master, they could probably keep going kind of in and out.
You could just have, you know, maybe then the same guy could come back an hour later.
I wonder how many of those salesmen, though, did the thing that they were most used to, which is leaving the cases like in their car. And
well, probably if you're staying in a hotel at a jewelry store, you want them close by, so you probably, you know, you would take them, put them in the safety deposit box, and then get them out each morning and go to the convention floor, the sales floor, where you would be there for, then I guess. Retail outlets would come and walk around and look at the wares of the different jewelry salesmen. Yeah, I've never been to a jewelry salesman's convention, so.
We might have to look one of those up.
Yeah, good idea. Hanhart, as he was getting ready to cop his plea, this is kind of interesting. He took an overdose of some kind of painkiller, and they said it was a suicide attempt. He was, and he was out on bond. He was then arrested. This was just before it's right after he pled, but before he was actually sentenced and had to turn himself in. He was out on bond. He was arrested and put in a psychiatric unit, and then moved to the Metropolitan Correctional Center there in downtown Chicago. But I just wonder about that because he ends up not getting that much of a sentence. He got.
He pled guilty in 2002 in order to pay $5 million in restitution and was packed away to a Minnesota prison for 12 years,
okay.
For a 12-year sentence.
I got a feeling that's probably some kind of a ploy. It might have gotten him in a lower security prison. That might have been how he got up there to the one at, was it Red Wing, I think, Minnesota. Pete Tamburello from Kansas City was up there, I know, at one time. But it's a lower security prison. It's not, you know, one of those max securities where you got all the crazy people and gangbangers and drug dealers and all that kind of thing. And he actually copped. The U.S. attorney said it's remarkable that a person who was chief of detectives of the Chicago Police Department admits to being part of a racketeering conspiracy. It's probably how he kept it down for more like 20 or 25 years. Here's a little postscript, kind of interesting little postscript I found. A letter from Jerry the Monk Scalise. Remember, we just talked about him, Jerry Scalise. He and Art the Brain Rachel, I remember his name this time, were diamond thieves as well as all other kinds of thieves. They stole the Marlboro diamond, and they were in jail during the time Hanhart was active. Those two and one other guy, a guy named Jerry Puglia, Bobby Puglia, all got caught doing some crimes. They were the FBI was all over them. They had them wiretapped. They had bugs on them. They had cameras on them. They were they caught them plotting and following around a armored car. And their final, when they actually caught him and brought him in.
This was after they'd already gotten out for the Marlboro
this diamond. Was, yeah, this was after. This is real recent. This is in 2012, I believe. They were caught as they were getting ready to break into Angelo LaPietra's home, who was a former, now deceased, Chicago outfit boss. And they thought that he would have a whole lot of cash and expensive jewelry that they could break in there and steal, and then they caught them. They're getting ready to go to trial, and Jerry Scalise writes a letter that they intercepted. And the letter is to Hanhart. And what he says in the letter to Hanhart was that whenever you get ready to go to court, he said, everybody looks at you if you're guilty, and many defendants always forget that they did do the crime. They think they're not guilty. The only approach, Scalise wrote, was to make something else the issue in order to trick the jury.
To try to get these guys off of this crime. Well, they had done it because they were breaking into La Pietra's house because there'd been another break-in previously to Frank Calabrese.
Right, right. You remember that. That's why they did. In the family secrets trial, it came out that there'd been a break-in at Calabrese's home, and they got like $1 million worth of cash and jewels and stuff. So they thought that La Pietra would have that kind of a thing. But it's just interesting why he would he was like exchanging letters with Hanhart, and the government tried to use that particular sentence. Or a series of sentences about, even though you may forgot you did the crime, you did do the crime, and everybody already assumes you're guilty, and the only approach, he said, is to make something else the issue in order to trick the jury. It kind of doesn't make sense in our world, but it makes sense in their world.
Yeah, maybe what Scalise was trying to do was distract folks by getting Hanhart in trouble.
That could be. It could be. I'm sure he had some kind of a connection to Hanhart.
Well, these guys wouldn't have been doing all of this extracurricular activity after they got out for the Marlboro Diamond heist, you would think, if they end up getting the Marlboro Diamond, because no one ever recovered it.
Right.
And given it's a 45-carat diamond, they cut it up into smaller stones. It had to be worth quite a bit.
You'd think so. But, you know, again, I mean, you got to figure out how to fence this stuff. So you got to get some jeweler who then won't question the history of it or won't question the background. So he's going to be a scam jeweler. He's going to be a fence, a criminal himself. And he knows it's stolen, so he's only going to give you like 25 cents on the dollar. So when they say they stole $5 million worth of jewelry or they got $100,000 worth of jewelry, well, what they actually sold it for was more like $25,000.
Yeah, they always give you the retail value of whatever it was
right,
stolen.
Not the high retail value.
Not the wholesale.
They value, the wholesale value is probably less than half. There's more than 100% markup in jewelry. I'm sure of that. And then the markup from the stolen jewelry is even more, because those guys will sell it for whatever they can get out of it. And the guy that buys it is taking a risk, so he's not going to even pay wholesale price. He's going to pay, like I said, probably 25 cents on the dollar of the retail, probably about half, 50 cents on the dollar of the wholesale.
Well, you get $500,000 in jewelry, that's still $125,000.
Yeah, it is, but it's a long ways from $500,000. So yeah. Then you got to split it up four or five ways. So then you're down to $25,000 or $30,000 each.
It's probably hardly get you through the month.
For a lot of people, it hardly gets you through the month. If you're a drug addict, it barely gets you through the month. Or if you're a gambler, a lot of them are gamblers, and they'll run out to Vegas and drop that in a night or two. So it's, and then, you know, when they go to jail, then they go to jail for 4 or 5 years, and they end up making about 10 bucks an hour, if even that.
Well, if they never recover any of the stuff, maybe they have some stash, you know, waiting for them when they get out.
Yeah, usually not.
That's where I was reading here where the, was it the widow had said, and Hanhart's family said his life shouldn't be defined by his court case, with one of his seven children, Sarah, describing him as a wonderful man who lived his whole life just helping other people.
He would probably launder that cash through and get it put in some kind of investments or buy some property, rental property or something with it. But most of these professional criminals, they don't do that. They just blow it. They go out and live the life and blow the money and then go do another score. Live the life, blow the money, go do another score. Very few of them would be like Hanhart, who would have any discipline with their money. And some of these top mob guys had discipline with their money.
Well, Hanhart was getting his $70,000 a year.
Yeah, he got his pension. He got a $70,000 a year pension until he died, even while he was in the penitentiary. As long as you retire before you take your conviction, then you get your pension. I think there's a new statute, and other states have done this, that if you get convicted of a felony even after you retire, each statute will be different. They've been working on one in Missouri that is like within a year after you retire, something like that. I believe this one that they're working on, they haven't got it passed yet. But if you get a felony after you retire, they can take your pension. They can stop your pension. But up until recently, that they didn't do that. The pension funds, you know, you earned your pension by working those 25 or 30 years, and so they're going to pay it to you.
Even if you weren't a clean cop.
Right, because actually you paid into the pension system. The officers paid into the pension system, and the city pays, instead of paying you a little larger salary, pays a percentage of your salary into the pension system. So it's not really a gift. You work for it.
Yeah.
That's kind of a misnomer. A lot of people think it's just some kind of a gift.
Well, probably the same way with $1,000 and two cars.
Yeah.
Or a car every 2 years. It wasn't really a gift. He had to earn that.
He had to earn it. Yes, he did. He did. God, what kind of a life would that be?
I don't know, 1,300 wiretap conversations,
man,
that were worth keeping.
To live that kind of a double life.
In
I just
year.
Can't even imagine. Aaron, can you imagine living that kind of a double life?
But they wouldn't want this to spread too far. I mean, they kind of clamped all this down. They didn't go to the officers that he would engage to help him. Not committing the crimes, but you know, if you were like, well, hey, remember me?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just wanted to know if you could run this license plate for me.
Yeah, they went to some of them. I know that this guy I know had that going, and they ended up forcing a Wyandotte County deputy sheriff who was helping this guy out using the police computer. They got him to cop a plea, I think just to a misdemeanor, but they got him to fired and made him cop a plea to a misdemeanor. Many times it's really hard. If they go for a jury trial, it may be kind of based on the criminal's word alone. If you don't have some pretty good substantiating evidence, corroborating evidence would be a better word, then sometimes it's kind of hard to get a conviction on a police officer. So they're more likely to take a cop a plea and get some easier case, easier sentence.
Yeah, you need like a jilted wife.
Yeah, well, that's
who may not have been there but would come forward, and her testimony seems really compelling.
There's been many a dude that have gone down because of a woman scorned, believe me. hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And, you know, I used to do that as a policeman. I remember one night I was at a mob bar, and I saw this guy, this mob kind of associate guy, come out. And a woman came out at the same time, and I wanted to follow him and see where he was going, and he was following this woman that came out. And I believe they, like, kissed or embraced or something and then split up. And he starts following her, and as I'm getting ready to drive out of the parking lot to follow both of them, another car pulls out, and there's another car following them, and so I'm following all three cars. And we drive out onto, it was real close to I-29. We drive out onto I-29. It was north of the river. It actually, it was one of the Sabellas owned a bar up there in the Islander building. So I'm following along. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and no other cars on the road but us, what, four cars. We drive on up I-29. They get off on, I think it's AA Highway, and they go into an apartment complex. And I'm able to kind of pull up in one little bit higher part of the parking lot in the apartment complex and just watch the dude and the girl that he's following pull in and get out. And this other car pulls in and then blocks both of them. And there's a woman jumps out, and I could see that she is mad. And she starts screaming at this guy. And I couldn't exactly make out what she was saying, but it was pretty obvious. I figured out later what the deal was. That was his wife. And she caught him going up to some apartment with some gal he just met at this club. And so I followed, and she left then, and he and the other gal went on into the apartment. So I followed her and went back over in the city, and she parked over at their house, and they lived in a house where she had to park on the street. So I took one of my business cards that said, you know, Detective Gary Jenkins Intelligence Unit, and wrote a note on the back and said, you know, give me a call if you want some help. and left it there. I never heard a word from her. But, yeah, to get a woman like that to start informing, because they'll know all the secrets. They'll know where a lot of the bodies are buried, because these guys will brag in front of them, and they'll know what's going on. Those are the best informers to get.
Yeah, they're all completely oblivious as four cars make their way well, from the same bar to the same exit into the same apartment complex.
You got to understand, of course, he and the girlfriend right. are probably drunk. They've probably been in the bar all night because it's closing time.
Yeah.
So they're probably drunk. And then the wife is, she wasn't looking behind her. She was looking ahead at them. I was the only probably halfway sane one of all three of them, and I was just kind of laying back. It was easy to follow three cars that were all, you know, going in a train. That's a no-brainer there, especially when they all make the same turn each time. And I don't know, you know, he may have realized that somebody was following him. He certainly figured out when he pulled in that apartment complex and she came flying up behind him and jumped out.
If he was that mobbed up, he might have been really concerned until his wife jumped
well,
out.
Well, he probably was until she jumped out. And then he breathed a sigh of relief. He was glad it was just the ex-wife.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's a good one. You know, that's
soon-to-be ex-wife.
Soon-to-be. No, probably not. They're Catholic. They'll stay married forever. They'll patch it up a little bit. All those mob guys have girlfriends, man. That's just part of it. What is it, Gomar? I learned that from The Sopranos. I never really heard that used here, although I did on the wiretap. Actually, I think maybe Tuffy used it because he had a Gomar. Ugly gal. Had the greatest body in the world, but, boy, she had a face to... she had a face that would scare you, man.
A butter face. That's what they call them.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I didn't know that term.
Everything butter face.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, really. She was a butter face. All right. Well, I think that finishes up with Mr. William Hanhart. You know, a lot of people, probably a lot of our listeners out there, think that policemen always cover for each other, but believe me, they don't. A whole lot of us, when you find out a policeman's actually committing crimes, I may not tell you about him beating somebody up, or if I'm there, I may minimize that, but somebody's actually out there committing crimes, why, there's a lot of us that will go after them. And they went after this guy in Chicago, although probably the feds were a big impetus in that. He had gotten so sophisticated and so high up, your city policeman would have had a really hard time getting this guy, because you had to have wiretaps and U.S. attorneys on board, because you could not have put Cook County district attorney's office and Cook County courts back in those days was, they were even more corrupt maybe than the police department was. There were no secrets from the outfit in Cook County for a long time, whether it be sheriff's office, you had Richard Kane. You guys up there know Richard Kane, and he was a highly placed sheriff's detective. I don't remember what kind of a rank he was. He was real close to the one sheriff they had up there for a long time. He actually, I found out later from somebody, Richard Kane was, who is a totally separate deal from Hanhart. Richard Kane actually was Italian. I wondered about it because I need to do a story on him. I was reading about him, and he actually left the Cook County Sheriff's Office, went to Mexico when Sam Giancana kind of went on a hiatus down there and was his driver for a long time. He ended up getting killed in a mob hit in a restaurant in Chicago after he came back. But they were, they had their hooks into the law enforcement and the criminal justice system for sure. If you've got a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or for purchase on Amazon. And then you want to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City, including maybe that bar that Gary mentioned. After that, you're going to want to get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Read the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And then, for another $1.99, get the Kindle version that has the actual audio from the wiretaps with hyperlinks that you can listen to and read the transcription of the words from the mouth of the men that did it.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
She was kind of goofy, too. I once had a deal where her daughter, this is before I even knew she was Tuffy's girlfriend. Her name was, what was it? It was Carol DeSocca or something like that. And she had a daughter, a teenage daughter, who got in some kind of trouble. And I was working, it was a larceny deal, and I was working a larceny. I was a young detective. And so I went over to talk to the mother about this, and she was like, all in my shit. She was all in my face, like, well, what are you doing messing with my daughter? I didn't get it. 5 years later, I got it. Now, she was a mob girlfriend. She was a girlfriend to the underboss of Kansas City. And she kind of, she lived that criminal's life or understood that criminal's life.
The police were the enemy. Didn't you nose him in on her daughter?
Really? It was crazy.